I kind of encourage them to mine themselves for those parts of themselves that they don't even realize are useful in their work. Because the stuff that I'm proudest of often came from a place that I didn't realize a book was going to come out of.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with J. Robert Lennon about his new literary double feature, his novel Subdivision and his book of short stories, Let Me Think. Two books that toy with what may be real, what may not be, what is mundane, and what might be considered supernatural. J. Robert Lennon is the author of 9 novels, including Familiar, Broken River, and Subdivision. He lives in Ithaca, New York. John, welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you, Lauren. It's really nice to be here.
How are you? How has this year been for you?
Oh, it's been just great. No, I'm sorry. I feel like no one can really ask that question with a straight face these days, but it's actually been okay. There has been a minimum of illness and suffering in my immediate family, and we're all vaccinated now, and I've managed to get a little bit of work done and teach some classes, so it hasn't been too bad.
Well, let's talk about these books. I'd like to talk about your novel, Subdivision, first. Your protagonist in Subdivision is female. Why write through the lens of a woman? Why do that? What does that perspective offer you, the writer, that perhaps a male perspective doesn't or can't? And what does it offer the reader then?
I don't think it's calculated or even really thought through what the gender of a protagonist in a story or a novel of mine is going to be. Usually the idea for something comes kind of naturally and without any preconception, and I don't know what it is and I don't know what it's going to become. In this case, the word naturally is vague, I know, but it occurred to me, I pictured this woman arriving in a small town with amnesia, not understanding why she's there or what she's supposed to do, and then I had to invent a story for her. And I had been, well, I don't want to give away too much of the backstory of the novel since most people will probably figure out what's going on about halfway through, but she's endured some kind of trauma. And when that occurred to me, I began to do a bunch of research on the kind of trauma that I thought she might have gone through and how people who've endured such things process it. A lot of my recent work is kind of about people processing some kind of trauma. So I hope that's not an evasive answer, but I didn't think it through until it was too late. And then I had to figure out how to do it.
Okay. So yes, you say that this protagonist, this female protagonist comes to arrive in this town. She is staying in a room in a guest house or something like a B&B. She stays in a room with mercy on the door. John, are you a merciful or a merciless person?
As a real person out in the world, I'd like to think I'm merciful. I'm very forgiving of the foibles of people I know and who are around me. But as a novelist, I'm afraid I cause the people I make up to suffer. Since they're imaginary, I guess it doesn't matter. But sometimes my books and stories are about disturbing things or people going through experiences that I hope no one I actually know has to go through.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know what that answer would be if you were, say, a nonfiction writer or like a confessional poet.
Yeah, I do not envy the work of nonfiction writers, especially journalists who have a kind of responsibility that maybe I don't. I think I have some kind of responsibility, but not the same kind of someone who's reporting on real people would.
Well, I mean, in a sense, you are kind of a nonfiction writer. You are a book critic, right? You write book reviews. Yeah. So in that sense, or as a book critic or a book reviewer, are you merciful or merciless?
I'm probably a little more merciless in book reviews than I am in interpersonal relationships with people, but not out of any kind of sense of malice. More or less, I try to give my impressions of a book, what I think it's like to read, what its strengths and flaws are. I try to avoid reading reviews of my own work, not just because I don't like to be criticized. I guess no one does, but I also don't really like to be praised because the things that I think are important about my books, other people are just not going to see them the same way. They're not going to notice the things I want them to notice. And I'm in the position of, even when someone likes it, that I feel like they're liking it incorrectly. And I don't like to be in that position. So I'd just as soon not know. And I've told my publisher not to tell me when the book gets reviewed. Although sometimes my mom will see a review and want to talk to me about it. So I'll read it to talk to her about it.
I want to go back to Subdivision. And you're going to have to tell me how to pronounce this demon creature's actual title, right? Like the Bakemono or the Bakemono?
I think it's Bakemono. It's a Japanese term for a type of supernatural creature. I'm using it as mostly because it's a catchy and unfamiliar name for a shape-changing demon from Japanese folklore, but I make no claims to it being quote-unquote authentic to its origins. But yeah, I think that's how it's pronounced.
So this character, this Bakemono, is, as you said, it's this shape-shifting creature in the novel, and it is in all of its forms seductive. And in the novel, your protagonist uses the word capitulation, right, to describe her behavior towards him or it. Can you tell readers a little bit more about this character, the Bakemono, and its role in the narrative, but even further, how you came to write it, its evolution in the novel?
I think it came along with, as I developed the backstory for this novel. In fact, I think it was before I developed the backstory. I wanted there to be some kind of shape-changing antagonist against which or against whom the protagonist has to push in order to reach some goal. And I was just kind of messing around with the first scene where this creature appears, first appears as a landlord at what is sort of like a haunted rental house. And I wrote the scene before I knew what was going on in the had gone on in the back, you know, the backstory of the book. But I would say, if I can back up a little, everything that is strange in this book is, it's supposed to be kind of dreamlike. There is, in my mind, there's a sort of canonically real story behind it all that is not in the book, but that everything in the book is a kind of dreamlike reprocessing of people and events from the protagonist's past. And this is a person, it's versions in her mind of a person who was cruel to her. And I think the way I came around to thinking of it is, like, if you are any kind of empathetic person and someone hurts you and you care about them, you don't want to blame them. You want to be sympathetic to them. You want to empathize with their plight, right? The danger, of course, is that you end up blaming yourself for something that's not your fault and that is somebody else's fault. And so I think that's what this narrator is grappling with. And the Bakemono, in his various incarnations, are examples of her trying to figure out how to process what went on between her and the real life version and memory of this creature.
You said that there's a dreamlike quality to this book, this narrative, and you use a word, or you've written a word throughout it, and you might even have to tell me how to pronounce this one too, nystagmus?
Oh, yeah. I think it's nystagmus, yeah. And the reason I use that is, the reason I even know that word is that there was a really weird rock band in Philadelphia in the 80s and 90s called Nystagmus. They were like a stoner jam band who would play at the sort of party scene around the campus where I went to college. And I had to look it up then, and it stuck with me. And it's just a condition with the eyes are out of sync, right? One is sort of wheeling in its socket.
Well, A, that's a good band name. Yeah. I like it. I'm going to have to look that one up. But yeah, you're right. It's this, kind of like dancing eye condition, or like dancing eyes, I think. It reminded me of what is called rapid eye movement, right? This idea of REM sleep. It does seem like your novel has a bit of dream logic. And not only in the physicality of the environments, but there's a logic between the characters, right? The really erratic way your protagonist interacts with others, like with a really intimate familiarity, but also as though a stranger. And the interactions kind of flit really quickly between those two polarities. Are you able, or can you, for me, characterize the logic of your novel?
I feel like it's more associative than logical, exactly, really. It's, you know, things pop up that put the narrator onto a different track, that remind her of something that she doesn't even realize is a memory. We keep saying dreamlike, but it's a quality of dreams that people can change into other people suddenly. Places that are far apart can suddenly be connected to each other. Impossible things occur very naturally, and wildly inappropriate emotions and reactions to things are common. And I wanted to sort of take some of these qualities and put them in the real world as a way for her to kind of process her memories, if that makes sense. And some of the books that influenced it are Kazuo Ishiguro's novel, The Unconsoled, which I discovered when I was living in Missoula, and it made a huge impression on me, and I just recently reread. And Catherine Davis's book, Duplex, her novel Duplex, which also involves a small town, a small dreamlike town. And there was one other sort of influence that wasn't even a book, but a writer I know, Jonathan D., was telling me that he'd just finished a novel, which is now out and is good. I can't remember the name of it, but it's his last book. And he said it was so much fun to write. It was like a little wind-up toy. And I just wound it up and put it on the table, and it just kept on going. And I really wanted to write a book like that. I wanted to have that feeling of a little toy that moves under its own power. I started thinking about dollhouses and playrooms, and, you know, what the imaginative play that you engage in when you're a child, moving characters around and having them talk to each other. It's kind of what a novelist does. But I wanted to bring that toy-like feeling into the way this little town is constructed and what the objects in it can do. Like, when you're a kid, if you need one character to suddenly be another character, you just make it happen, right? And this idea that this childlike intuitive logic is being applied to this woman's adult life was compelling to me.
Was the writing process for this novel as fluid as you wanted it to be?
The writing process was great. It was the most fun I've ever had writing anything. I would say the revision process was less pleasant because the result of writing it very quickly was that I didn't even realize what I had done. Like, I feel like second and third drafts for me are, the first draft is just sort of getting into a fugue state where I can just zip forward and put into the book whatever it occurs to me to put in. And as I get ideas, I put them in a note. It used to be in a notebook. Now it's like on my phone or the notes app on my computer, that I just add stuff to it. And when I feel like I'm slowing down, I'll draw a new idea from it and add it to the book. And it makes the process really fun and exciting, like I'm playing. And then I have to face that this thing I made has to make sense in some sense, and it has to be communicable to other people. It has to have pacing. It has to have balance. And at first, anyway, it's very hard for me to know what it needs, which is why I have writer friends and my book editor and my literary agent who read drafts and tell me what I ought to do.
Okay, so we've been talking about subdivision. Maybe now's the time. Will you read an excerpt from it?
Yeah, for sure. There's this bit where, so the protagonist has I don't think we've mentioned yet, has a digital assistant, sort of like Alexa or Siri, named Sylvia, who is surprisingly and unusually independent and intelligent. She's been carrying this device around for a couple of days. And after a difficult day, she has a conversation with Sylvia right when she's going to bed. And I'm going to read that. The day's events kept replaying themselves in my head, inviting me to second guess my every action and reaction. Each instance of social intercourse made me doubt my decency and personal worth. Had I offended the drugstore clerk? Had I been inadequately respectful of Justine's impressive work on the apartment? What had I said or done to displease the judge? Even my memory of the demonic badger hissing at me from the curb engendered feelings of shame and inadequacy. Had I led him on with my girlish swooning over his enchanted bungalow and seductive human form? And if so, wasn't he now my responsibility? Somehow, though, I managed to feel worst about my treatment of Sylvia, who stood silently on the table beside me. I'd harbored such doubts about her when all she wanted was to assist and protect me. "Sylvia, I'm sorry," I said quietly. It took a moment for her to wake. She flickered pale blue before settling back into her usual peachy glow, more subdued now that it was night. "I'm sorry," she said. "I don't understand. Please repeat your request." "I was just saying I'm sorry," I said. "I'm sorry," Sylvia said. "I don't understand that command." "You're right. I'm sorry. That makes no sense." "I'm sorry. Did you want me to perform a task for you?" "No, I'm sorry," I said. I lay in silence for a few minutes. Sylvia remained powered up and alert, as though anticipating my inevitable change of mind. "Actually, Sylvia," I said, "would you please tell me a story?" Sylvia glowed blue again. She said, "Here's a list of breaking news stories. Local business person wins religious award. Automobile moratorium to remain in effect. Study shows eating both healthy and not healthy. Road to city to remain impassable. Area bird lays unusual egg." "Not that kind of story," I clarified. "You know, a story like a fictional narrative, the kind you get in a movie or book." "Fictional narrative is not among my functions." "I bet you can do it," I said, turning toward her and propping my head up with my hand. "Go read some stories, or scan them, or input them, or whatever. Then just do what they do." "One moment, please," Sylvia said, and began to pulse blue. She brightened and dimmed, slowly at first, then more and more quickly, until the pulses turned to flashes, and the flashes to a dull and constant shine. I could feel, more than hear, a hum emanating from her body, a musical note changing in pitch and timbre just below the range of human perception. It was as though she were singing to herself in a register only she could hear. Then the blue disappeared, and Sylvia returned to her default peach and said, "Happy Families had gone too far. Its walls had been behaving. The rest of his face was a wheelchair, and in the forest, Howard said that the housekeeper was a leaden mask. The son did not deny that he should be subjected to hanging, and a faded red bathrobe was almost impossible to perform. So, from the fourth side, the bones fell on the rug, purple-nailed, folded loosely on the land. I sat there with Sally, unhappy in its own way, alone in the face by the sodden leaves. A French girl had been thrown down, forming at one point a mound, and everything was confusion in the street. We sat in the same house with the poor woodcutter, and if the Potters had a small son, too, then the rest of his face was a delaying tactic. Some of us had been lined with human remains, and everything was in confusion. The son did not like it, and then, in a space of hexagonal flags, we sat in the hail, and she announced to her husband that she could not go on living. 'I'll tell you what,' Colby said, 'we will light a fire for them, and give each of them one piece of bread more. And then we will light a fire for them, and give each of them one piece of bread more. And then we will light a fire for them, and give each of them one piece of bread more. And then we will take the children out into the forest and lay promiscuously on the bones.' A few locks of dry white hair clung to his wife, and she said, 'How I wish we had something to do.' And the Dursleys arrived in the fashion of an orchestra. The son sat in the circumscribing walls of solid granite, and the children ran wild over what the music was going to be. The end." For several seconds, I remained silent, digesting what Sylvia had recited. Then I said, "That was perfect. That was a wonderful story."
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with novelist and short story writer J. Robert Lennon. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. So I want to talk a little bit about Let Me Think Too, but I want to talk about the relationship between these two books. How do you see these two books complementing one another?
I hadn't seen it at all until I started reading aloud from them for these book events, and I realized there are a lot of people imprisoned in their own minds, I think, in both of these. It's a running theme of these stories that people are caught often in a loop or a repetition of thought, or they trap themselves logically or emotionally or intellectually. And the style is, you know, departs from representational reality in a lot of them as well. Some of them are a little bit more conventional, but others are not.
Well, how about let's hear an excerpt from Let Me Think so readers have an idea of what we're talking about here.
Great. All day, the child has been trying to get the window open. He's 4 and he isn't strong enough. The father has noticed this, but it's winter and he doesn't want the window open, so he's been ignoring the child's efforts. Eventually, the child cries and the father asks him what's wrong. I can't open the window. Well, I don't want you to open the window. It's cold out. But I have to get the pins. What pins? The pins. What the child is talking about is a cache of small safety pins he slipped under the sash one unseasonably warm day when the window was open. He wants the pins because tomorrow he's going to preschool, and his friend Julia wears the same kind of socks he does, and he figures he can put the safety pins on his socks so that they won't get mixed up. But today, anyway, this is beyond his power to explain. The father goes to the window and looks out into the yard. I don't know what you're talking about. Later that day, the child manages to slide a metal ruler underneath the sash and is able to pry open the window. He sees the pins and reaches for them, but the ruler slips and the window crushes his hand. He wails in pain. The father examines the hand. I told you not to play at the window, he says. I need the pins, says the child. Arthur, I don't know what you mean. The pins! The pins! Please stop crying and tell me what you mean. I need the pins. The father is exasperated. The child is sent to bed early. The next day, at school, the children make a puppet theater. They use their socks as puppets. The child's socks are mixed up with his friend's, and he returns home with a mismatched set. This isn't your sock, his father says. I know. Where's your sock? Julia has it. Then whose is this? Julia's. Oh, the father scratches his head. We should put your initials on them or something. Your socks, so you know they're yours. The father looks at the child's hand. It is discolored where the window landed on it. Does this hurt? No. What do you think? Should we put your initials on your socks? Okay. But they don't get around to it. The father is pretty busy, and the child's mind wanders. Eventually, the child is given new socks that look nothing like Julia's. Spring comes, and the father replaces the storm windows with screens. He finds the little pile of safety pins. He says to himself, "Where the hell did these come from?" And he throws them into a drawer.
Thank you. My other question, what books are you reading right now, or what books would you recommend readers follow yours with?
I will just say what I've been reading lately. I just finished reviewing the new Rachel Cusk novel, Second Place. And it's the first fiction she's published since the trilogy of books that began with Outline, which have been well received and have a certain style to them. And so I think people were wondering, where do you go from there? Because they're so distinctive. My friend Alex Higley has a story collection called Cardinal that I really like. The stories are written, they're mostly quite short. They're written in a kind of shorthand, so a lot of important information is left out. But as I was saying earlier in our interview, I really like stories that leave a lot to the imagination, and his do. Let's see. I read the new Stephen King later. I'd say it's in the top. I'd say it's in the 25th percentile. The 75th percentile. So among the best, I think he's written 100 books. So it's probably one of the 25 or 30 best Stephen King books. I've read him since I was an adolescent, so he's not a guilty pleasure. I'm not guilty about anything, but he's something I've enjoyed since my youth, and so I always read his new stuff.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, do you seek out his work now that, I mean, the literary marketplace is saturated?
Yeah. I don't always get through all of them, but I always start them to see if they're going to appeal to me. I feel like he, in his super long books, he's kind of out of ideas. He keeps doing the same stuff, kind of stuff that he does. There's always a battle between good and evil at the end. But when he writes something shorter, he had a collection of novellas that I reviewed for the LRB a few years ago. And this book is, did you ever see this series of books called Hard Case Crime? They're paperbacks, and they have pulp novel covers. They look like they were published in the 50s or 60s. And they do like mystery and crime and a little bit of horror. And I like them because they're short. And the writers who publish with them tend to give them something that's a little off the beaten track of their usual work, that's a little shorter, that they might think of as trifling in some way. But I usually like when writers do stuff like that, that they think they're just messing around, you know? And I feel like they're channeling their true selves in a way with that kind of work. So this book I enjoyed because it was short and exciting and had, unlike his longer stuff, really unexpected twists and turns to it. So,
would you consider Let Me Think one of those books for you? Do you feel like it was at some point just you trifling around and then it became something bigger?
I tried to make my whole career that. I found after the first sort of 10 years of, I don't like disown my earlier stuff. I'm still proud of it, but I do feel like I'm most satisfied by my work when I convince myself that I'm just messing around and that no one is ever going to read it. And then by the time it becomes a real book, it's too late. I've gone too far down that road. I've invested too much time in it. And now I have to see it through this silly idea. And I do feel like something I tell my students is like, students want to learn how to do it, right? And there are examples that you can give them and there is advice you can give them. There are sort of there are conventions they can follow that will be satisfying in a certain way. But ultimately, the thing about them that people are going to love is the thing that they can do that other people can't. And sometimes that thing is embarrassing. Sometimes you want to think of yourself as dignified and following in the footsteps of a tradition of writers. But in fact, you are a freak, and the reason you're being a freak is why you want to be a writer, because no normal person wants to do this. A lot of people would like to have written, but only a few people actually want to write. And I feel like it kind of encouraged them to mine themselves for those parts of themselves that they don't even realize are useful in their work, because that's how I feel about my work. The stuff that I'm proudest of often came from a place that I didn't realize a book was going to come out of.
As a professor, are you just looking for those little bits in students' writing? Like, what does it mean to embrace those, or like encourage the freak in everyone?
I mean, maybe it's not for everybody. I think maybe the students behind my back are saying he just wants everybody to be weird. But I think most students are surprised and pleased when I or their peers in class pick out something about the work that they didn't realize was unique or they didn't realize was important and say, I've never seen anything like that before. You should do more of that. I mean, it's certainly what I wanted to hear when I was younger and the kind of thing that would give me the confidence to go out on a limb and try something that would not necessarily be immediately socially acceptable / successful. So I like to think that I have a reputation among students for being able to point that stuff out or enjoying pointing that stuff out. But who knows?
John, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Lauren. I appreciate you reading the books, and those were great questions.
Look for more information about John at mtpr.org. where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Ostein. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.